Salman Rushdie, what is your take on what the Bush administration is doing with Iraq?
I'm pretty disturbed about it. You know, I mean, in my view, war should be a last resort and not a preemptive thing. And, you know, so I have great concerns about it. I mean, having said that, you know, I'm not of the view that Saddam Hussein is no problem and should be left alone. I think he is a dangerous man, and there's evidence to show that he is engaged in procuring material which could be used in a nuclear device and so on. I just think that, you know, the United States, powerful as it is, cannot afford to be entirely isolated in the world. The world is too interdependent these days. And if there's going to be a move against Saddam's regime, it has to be a move with which the world concurs. And that's why it seems to me, I mean, I was encouraged to see in the paper that perhaps under British pressure, the U.S. administration seems to be agreeing to a kind of time span during which the inspectors might be sent in. Because, you see, I think if the inspectors were to go in, and if he starts harassing them as he did before, it's going to become much easier to construct some kind of international agreement that the regime change needs to take place. You know? But to ignore the fact that he's climbed down and allowed the inspectors in and just go attack him anyway, in a way puts the Americans in the wrong, and that's the wrong way to go about it, it seems to me. Also, the main concern, about which I need a lot more reassurance, really, is that you shouldn't go into a war unless you know how to get out of it. I mean, that's to say, what next? You know, it's regime change is one thing, but how are you going to put that new regime in place? Will it be democratic? Will it be militaristic? Will it be just another strong man instead of Saddam? And will it involve a very long-term presence of a large number of American and perhaps British troops in Iraq, you know, for perhaps a generation, you know? If that is the case, we need to be told. If there's a more finite plan to get out fast, we need to be told how it'll work. I think you can't go into a war unless you know how you're going to handle the situation after the war. And I think that's one reason why a lot of the generals seem reluctant to embark on this, you know, because generals don't like to commit their troops who are going to be hurt or killed, and who are obviously going to hurt and kill other people, unless they know what the end is, you know, and here we don't know.
Molly Ivins made the comment in a recent column that the Bush doctrine, this first strike doctrine, was actually engineered for Bush 1 administration, oddly enough, by the same two people who engineered it now, Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz.
Mm-hmm.
And they were planning to use it against the Soviet Union. And it seems like there's a mindset there that doesn't take into account that the geopolitical world has changed in a decade.
I think it's very unwise for the United States to become the kind of country that decides it has the right to preemptively strike anybody because they think that that person may do something bad in future. I mean, it's very bad law, that principle, and it's certainly not in line with the values that a democratic and open society such as this, you know, is supposed to be defending.
In Step Across This Line, you make a point of talking about that curious dichotomy of anti-Americanism, which on the one hand trashes Americans and on the other hand glorifies the American culture. What do you think that is really about? Just fear? Is it fear?
I think a part of it is post-Cold War. I mean, I think, you know, in the Cold War, when there was the Soviet Union versus America, so to speak, and each had its so-called sphere of influence, well, just put it to its crudest, that the amount of available global power was divided between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Now, since 1989 and the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's only one game in town. You know, there's only one player. And I don't think there's ever been a situation in the world where one nation held so many of the cards, you know, was in a position of such gigantic power and influence. Now, the downside of that is people are going to bitch a lot. You know, it's just
right.
It just comes with that territory, you know. I think some of the people doing most of the bitching in Western Europe are, interestingly, people from the countries which previously exerted great influence in the world, like Britain and France. You know, now, clearly, those countries no longer occupy, you know, the catbird seat, so to speak, you know, and I think there is a large amount of resentment of the fact that, so to speak, the torch has passed, you know, and this is not the age of the British Empire anymore, it's the age of the American Empire, if you like, and that breeds resentment amongst countries which believe that they want to be major players, you know, and suddenly have to accept a very subsidiary role.
Well, that would tend to say that they're not speaking from any kind of morality, they're speaking from ego.
Well, I think it's one thing about, you know, that there are disagreements about specific issues such as the invasion of Iraq and so on, you know. I'm not talking about that. I mean, those, you could argue, are principled oppositions. I'm just talking about the kind of almost gleeful, told you so, got what you deserved attitude that was so prevalent in Britain and in Europe in the immediate aftermath of the September 11 attacks, you know, at a time when you would have thought that countries which are supposed to be the friends of America would have reacted empathetically, not just sympathetically, but being able to put themselves in the shoes of the country to which this terrible attack had happened and to understand how people felt. I think that failure of empathy, that failure of imagination, I think has to do with what I'm talking about. It has to do with kind of ancient historical resentments.
Let's switch to anti-Americanism in the Mideast. Hmm. Is the resentment similar?
Some of it, it seems to me, is the inevitable consequence of the history of the region. That's to say, you know, it is true that the United States, and with the support of the British, toppled a perfectly legitimate government in Iran and installed what became the very tyrannical regime of the Shah of Iran. You know, so if people remember that, people have long memories in that region. You know, it is true that America has meddled in the politics of the region, and that leaves behind a sour taste and a legacy. Above all, the question of Israel and Palestine poisons the water, you know, and whether it's accurate or not to say so, most people in that part of the world believe that Israel is, so to speak, the 51st state, you know, and that it is in the power of the American government to force Israel to reach a settlement with the Palestinians. So that is what people think. You know, now you can argue that they're completely wrong, but it is what people think. And so until such time as that situation is resolved, and frankly, it's going the wrong way at the moment, but, you know, until such time as it is, that will poison the water as far as the Americans are concerned. So, I mean, that's, if you like, the geopolitical background. But I think there's another thing, which is that these are countries, in many cases, which have been great economic and political failures in the modern age. And it's extremely convenient to have a superpower, you know, a kind of big daddy to push the blame off onto. You know, and so I think it's been, for a generation and more, the practice of the politicians, the information media, and frankly even the schools, to create a situation in which the citizenry believes that all their problems are externally created, you know, because it just takes the heat off.
Well, Salman Rushdie, what about your native country of India? Is there anti-Americanism there?
No, there isn't. Actually, the one thing that did happen recently was the enormous positive impact of the Clinton visit. You know, when Clinton went to India, in his usual, you know, maximally seductive way, he simply took the place by storm, you know, and the country, in the most kind of nauseating way, fell in love with him. and it was a big shift, because in the previous period, in the years of the Cold War, India had had a very close political relationship with the Soviet Union, you know, and there was also a lot of economic and trade connections and so on. Because India had that relationship, because also India ran a fairly protectionist command economy of a kind of socialist kind, there was a kind of distance, let's say, between America and India. And Indians always felt that because of their connection to the Soviet Union, Americans were a little more inclined to favor Pakistan, even though Pakistan had a close alliance with China. You know, so, but that was the feeling. And so for a long time, relations were strained politically. But that's all changed now. I mean, I think, first of all, India now has a much more open economy. There was a long time, for example, when drinks like Coca-Cola, you know, could not be sold in India, and in order to protect Indian cola drinks, which I have to say, if you ever tasted, were some of the most revolting drinks in the world, you know. But now that's all changed. Those tariff barriers have come down. It's, as I say, so it's an open economy, and politically, since President Clinton went there, the connection to America is greatly improved.
But Bush is president now, and Bush has an alliance with Musharraf. Yes. Where does India fit in with that? And more importantly, what relationship does Kashmir have in terms of this strange triangle now?
Well, you see, I think India is pretty alarmed about the Musharraf connection with the United States. And, mainly because there's just no argument that Musharraf's regime has trained most of the terrorists who operate in Kashmir, and actually it's pretty likely that even this atrocity that happened just the other day in India, which seems to have been Muslim extremists, the pattern of that is very similar to the attack on the Indian Parliament last year, and those were almost certainly Pakistan-trained operatives. So, you know, there's a great worry that Musharraf, because he is pro-Bush on the other frontier, on the Afghan frontier, is being allowed to carry out terrorist operations on the Indian frontier. And clearly there's a double standard there, which is of great concern. Now, in my view, and I've written about it a lot in this book, that Kashmir, I think, is in a way as big an issue potentially as the Middle East, because here you're talking about, you know, you're talking about two nuclear powers. You're talking about two major nuclear powers facing each other across a ceasefire line. And this, I mean, already once this year, they've come very close to a nuclear exchange. And, you know, if, God forbid, there were to be one, I mean, it was calculated at the height of that trouble that if even one nuclear device were to be detonated in the subcontinent, that essentially the Indian economy would collapse within 24 hours, and so would the Pakistan economy. And remember that the Indian economy, let's even leave aside the issue of death, okay? Let's put that to one side. Just look at the money. India is the world's sixth biggest economy. And if you take that out overnight, do not believe it would not have repercussions on the Western world. You know, I mean, it would lead to a world economic collapse of a scale that has not been seen, you know, since the 30s. So the idea that this is a faraway, remote place, and it kind of doesn't matter that much if these people kind of do each other to death, you know, is really untrue. And I think it's time that the United States and indeed the United Nations woke up to that, because I think one of the weirdest things about that moment where India and Pakistan almost went to war is that the Security Council wasn't even in session.
And most people here didn't even know.
Didn't even know. And I mean, yet it is currently as big a flashpoint as the Middle East, if not potentially more dangerous.
The British had this strange idea of partition, and the three places where they used partition were in the Middle East, in Israel and Palestine, Pakistan and India, and Northern Ireland and rest of Ireland. And all three have been absolute and utter disasters.
Yeah, well, that's the title essay of the book is about exactly that, about, you know, it's about the drawing of frontiers across the world and the consequences thereof, you know. And, I mean, I was born, 8 weeks to the day before the independence and therefore the partition of India and the creation of Pakistan. And so I grew up with the consequences of that partition, the enormous massacres that took place immediately afterwards, the embitterment, you know, of what had been essentially one country, you know, its division into these embattled, oppositional, adversarial powers. And just at the level of my family was cut in half. You know, half my family was in Pakistan. I mean, my own bit of it preferred to be in India. So I lived through the dreadful consequences of that partition. And then remember coming to Europe. I mean, I came to England at the beginning of 1961, age 13. And a couple of months later, they built the Berlin Wall. You know, and I remember being horrified, thinking, what, they're going to partition Europe now? You know, is that same thing going to happen here? And so in my experience, that partitions, these kind of arbitrary, or not entirely arbitrary, but these very brutal separations of peoples by the drawing of frontiers in that way, have been catastrophic. And you're right, the British have a lot of responsibility for that.
What would you have seen as a solution? Let's suppose, okay, Salman Rushdie is in England, and he has a chance to say, what are we going to do about India? What do you do?
Well, you know, there were a lot of people opposed to the partition of India. I mean, a lot of Indian people. I mean, in fact, if you look at what happened, there are today more Muslims in India than there are in Pakistan. And it's because a lot of people, even people with Muslim backgrounds, did not want to particularly live in a theocratic state. You know, like my own parents, they saw themselves as Indian first and Muslim kind of 19th, probably, you know, because they weren't a very religious family. We weren't, mercifully. So they wanted to stay. You know, they stayed, right? That's why I grew up in Bombay, because for them, India was home, not some invented new Islamic state. Many, many, many Muslims thought like that. I mean, I think, frankly, the truth is that by the date of independence, by 1947, the partition was probably inevitable because the situation had become so embittered. I think you have to back up several years, you know. Around the key moment, in my view, is in 1940. In 1940, the Congress Party, which ran the revolution, the party of Gandhi and Nehru, issued what was called the Quit India Resolution, in which it said it would no longer collaborate with the British, it would no longer enter into state governments under the British aegis, it wanted the British to go. Right? This is 1940, remember, it's also the year of the Blitz, it's a year in which England was in a fairly, you know, weak position, and the Congress, Gandhi and Nehru, believed that it was the time to push, it was time to say, enough already, go away. Now, at that point, the Muslim leader, Jinnah, who was the head of the Muslim League, the main Muslim party, had been very alienated by Gandhi. Gandhi had actually annoyed him because previously Jinnah had been very anti-partition, but politically was frozen out by Gandhi and became a partitionist. What happened in 1940 when the Congress issued the Quit India Resolution is that very large numbers of Congress leaders were swept up and jailed, including Gandhi and Nehru, and the Muslim politicians took their places in the British puppet governments. At that point, I think the bitterness between the communities became so great that essentially the Muslims were accused of acting as scab labor, you know. After that, I think partition became more or less inevitable. But had there been some rapprochement between Gandhi and Jinnah in the late 30s, early 40s, I think it could have been avoided. And, you know, the countries would be in a much better state today if that was so.
Well, it would be one country.
Yeah. My view is that. I mean, I'm unfashionable these days in thinking that partition was avoidable and, you know, undesirable. I mean, frankly, if you go to India and Pakistan nowadays, you won't get many people to give you this argument because, you know, history has taken its course and people feel as they feel. They feel very embittered across that frontier. So there's no possibility, realistically, of it being undone, but I wish it hadn't been.